Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, March 28, 2014. More fighting in Jonglei State leaves dozens of civilians dead.
People are now on move. People are now on run. They are coming toward Panyagor. There's no food at all.
And the lessons learned from Rwanda conflict.
Institutions should work for the good of the country. I think Kenya did very well by coming up with a new constitution.
We will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Local officials say at least 12 civilians have been killed in 3 days of fighting between government forces and the opposition in Jonglei State this week. Army officials say the anti-government forces retain control of most of Du County, where the fighting has taken place. Philip Aleu has the story for VOA from Juba.
Du County Commissioner Elijah Moinomuor says he was forced to flee his home earlier this week to neighboring Panyagor after fighting broke out again in the area. The county has been the scene of several clashes between the Sudan People Liberation Army and anti-government forces this month. Moinom says the death toll will continue to rise so long as the fighting continues.
From the civilian, 12 people have been killed and 14 wounded. So their aim it is destruction and to loot and raid. That is the part of their aim.
Moinom says before fighting began in mid-December, there were at least 68,000 people living in the area. He says now most of them are gone.
People are now on move. People are now on run. They are coming toward Panyagor. There's no food at all, and they are now suffering on the road.
Opposition military spokesperson Lulwai Kwang says the SPLA attack forces stationed in the area earlier this week. He says they have refouled several attacks. He did not mention civilian casualties.
We reported the killing of 117 government forces. We captured 108 AK-47, 37 PKM light machine guns. Then we had one prisoner of war. We lost them. We lost 10 soldiers on our side.
Kwang says 68 opposition soldiers were injured in the fighting. Without providing an exact number, SPLA spokesperson Colonel Philip Aguir says the number of government forces killed is nowhere near 117. He says there are reports that some civilians have been killed, but again did not provide any numbers. Aguir blamed the fighting on anti-government forces.
They are occupying a part of Duke from Dukpadiet up to Marang, the capital of Duke County. The SPLA forces in the region are preparing to counter that attack, and their move is to push southward toward Bor. The SPLA is aware of their movement, and they have been gathering in a yurt.
Aguir says an SPLA counterstrike is imminent, but says he cannot reveal exactly when or where it will happen for security reasons. For VOA News, I'm Philip Aleu in Juba.
Each year in April, Rwanda and some other African countries pay homage to victims of the 1994 genocide. Those countries include Kenya, which has also had its share of political violence and intertribal fighting, especially after the 2007 presidential election. Since then, Kenya has made progress in building credible government institutions. But as Mohammed Yusuf reports for VOA, some analysts and activists are warning those gains are fragile.
Kenya's disputed presidential election in 2007 revealed how dangerous ethnic divisions and corruption can be to the country's citizens. Since then, the international community has pushed the country's leaders to implement political, police and judicial reforms in order to avoid a return to violence. Political analyst Adam Olo, a lecturer at the University of Nairobi, says Kenya must learn how to let institutions work without interference.
Kenya has also had its own lessons of the 2007-2008 post-election violence. And I think that what Kenya needs to learn is that basically institutions should work for the good of the country. I think Kenya did very well by coming up with a new constitution.
In 2010, more than 60% of voters approved a new Kenyan constitution to replace one that many saw as causing institutional weakness, in effect enabling the violence. The new constitution created a Supreme Court and set new procedures for appointing top officials in the government like judges and police. Late in 2012, a survey showed more than 80% of Kenyans had confidence in the courts. This confidence prompted the losing presidential candidate in that year's election, former Prime Minister Raila Odinga, to challenge the result in the Supreme Court, rather than calling for mass protest. The head of the group Inuka All Stand Up Kenya is John Githongo. He says some politicians are fighting the recent changes and warns the recent gains for democracy and rule of law could be erased.
The most important instrument for peace and spontaneity and harmonious life in Kenya is the constitution. And one of the disturbing things that we're seeing is very determined efforts to roll back some of the victories that have been won as a result of the new constitution.
Githonga says the constitution is the primary instrument for holding his countrymen together in a peaceful future. Political analyst Olo says if people lose faith in the new institutions, the country may witness violence.
To the extent that people lose confidence in the institutions that are supposed to ensure harmony or to pretend of conflictual issues or dispute resolution.
President Uhuru Kenyatta and Deputy William Ruto are facing charges at the International Criminal Court that helped to orchestrate the post-election violence. But the case against Mr. Kenyatta is on the verge of falling apart. A former anti-corruption campaigner, Githongo, notes the president and Ruto formed their alliance in part to fight the ICC and suggests things may change if the Kenyatta case is dropped.
Of course, one is forced to ask the question, if one of the main rationales that underlay this coalition is collapsing, then obviously there shall be realignment, and one hopes that those realignments can happen in a peaceful manner.
But Githongo doubts that will happen. He says the nature of Kenyan politics is that change is usually accompanied by some sort of violence. Mohammed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Getting rich does not automatically make a nation wealthier. That, according to a new research, the study questions whether promoting economic growth is the best way to improve children's nutrition in low and middle-income countries. VOA's Steve Baragona reports.
Harvard School of Public Health professor Subbu Subramanian says the conventional wisdom on how developing countries should improve children's health is basically this.
Let's just go after economic growth and then everything else will just follow.
But he says that's not always the case. India is booming, for example. The country's gross domestic product, or GDP, the most common measure of the economy, has been growing by more than 5% per year for most of the past two decades. That's faster than most Western countries. But more than two-fifths of India's children are underweight, and nearly half are stunted. And that has not changed much since the early 1990s. Subramanian and his colleagues wondered if economic growth was failing to reach children in other countries as well. So they looked at health surveys conducted since 1990 in 36 low- and middle-income countries, mostly in sub-Saharan Africa. Writing in the journal The Lancet Global Health, they found that when they compared the impact of GDP growth on indicators of child malnutrition, like stunted growth and being underweight, the effect was
practically zero to very, very small.
For every 5% growth in GDP, there was a less than 1% decrease in stunting, for example. Subramanian says that's because investments that raise GDP are not the ones that will improve child health. He criticizes India for building new highways and airports, while much of the country lacks basic sanitation. GDP growth needs to be funneled into clean water and sewers, childhood immunizations, breastfeeding promotion, and so on, he adds.
Without these direct investments, what we are seeing is economic growth by itself is not making much impact.
But the conclusion that economic growth has little or no impact on child nutrition drew this reaction from Lawrence Haddad, head of the Institute for Development Studies.
We think that's crazy.
Haddad says, look at countries like Vietnam, Ghana, or Brazil, where malnutrition has come way down in the last 20 years. Economic growth accounts for half of those declines, he says.
And the other half is attributable to strategic investment in water, sanitation, health systems, nutrition programs.
He says it takes both GDP growth and the right investments to raise child nutrition rates. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
In the past 12 months, thousands of children in Cameroon have died of severe diarrhea caused by rotavirus, with thousands more said to be hospitalized. The United Nations is providing a vaccine, but medics say the situation is difficult given the acute shortage of clean water. Moki Edwin Kinzeka has more for VOA from Yaoundé.
Five-month-old Gracious Yinyoi cries as he is administered Rotatec, a vaccine that protects babies against common types of rotaviruses. Dr. Nula Desiree says the baby is one of a million Cameroonian children they are out to save.
Le rotavirus provoque une maladie diarrhéique beaucoup plus courante.
The doctor says rotavirus has been causing diarrhea among children under 5 and is especially dangerous for kids between 12 and 24 months. The virus can lead to severe dehydration, and if nothing is done, the child dies. The United Nations says children vaccinated against rotavirus are 70% less likely to be hospitalized for diarrhea compared to unvaccinated children. But Dr. Desiree says vaccines alone will not solve the problem in Cameroon.
Il faut dire que globalement c'est un problème d'hygiène, d'hygiène de salubrité, d'hygiène du milieu, d'hygiène corporelle.
He says it must be made clear that the sickness is due to poor hygiene and sanitation. And he adds that people must have access to good quality water and deep latrines. Dr. Desiree says the vaccine without sanitation will be ineffective and the disease will continue to spread. Many towns in Cameroon are suffering from an acute shortage of drinkable water. The capital, Yaoundé, has gone without sufficient water for 3 months. Meanwhile, 70% of people in rural areas do not use latrines and prefer to defecate in bushes. Dr. Marie Kobela of the country's National Vaccination Program told VOA that basic hygiene in Cameroon needs to be improved.
Améliorer l'approvisionnement en eau, y compris le traitement et le stockage, l'hygiène du milieu, l'utilisation des latrines.
She says improve potable water supply, improve hygiene, use toilets, quickly go for oral rehydration if the child has diarrhea. Dr. Kobela adds that if a child vomits and if there are blood spots in what he or she throws up, the child should be taken immediately to a hospital. In Africa, rotavirus kills more than 600 children each day, and thousands more are hospitalized or require clinic visits. But the facilities are always not available. The United Nations is supporting the rotavirus vaccination program by making available about 1 million doses of vaccine. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Yaoundé.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Staying healthy is important to everyone, but it is particularly important if you're a woman expecting a baby. Women should get competent medical care as soon as they realize they're pregnant, and they should follow these general guidelines to increase the chances of having a healthy baby. Eat a variety of good foods with nutrients, including fruits and vegetables. Wash your hands and wash your food before preparing it. Also, wash your hands right before eating. Don't drink alcohol or smoke. Avoid pesticides, paint, or strong chemical cleaners. And decrease or eliminate coffee or tea. All these things can improve the chances of having a healthy baby.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we hear what you think about peace talks and the ongoing crisis. Stay tuned.
For all the latest in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to Voice of America's South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday, from 1630 to 1700 UTC. You can email us at southsudan@voanews.com. We are also on the web at voanews.com/South Sudan. Or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
where does your loyalty lie? Tribe or country? Do you have to choose?
My loyalty lies in my culture or my tribe. To my country, it is to a lesser extent. Sometimes I'm even not sure.
My loyalty lies on the country because it is the country where all the tribe live. Should I choose one tribe, then I have left my country and the other tribe, which can cause problem to the nation.
I am my tribe because I belong to my country, and I think I belong to that country within a particular tribe.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for your comments. I'm producer Gwen Uten in Washington. As the crisis continues, many of you have expressed regret over the failure of the leaders of the government and opposition to reach a deal. Jacob Dior in Rumbek Lake State says, "If recapturing Malakal town has become a monthly phenomenon for both the rebels and government forces, then the peace talks in Addis Ababa are of no use, but rather an opportunity for the delegates to sip Ethiopian coffee. The future of South Sudan is unpredictable if this senseless war does not stop." Mario Gabriel Akon in Kwajuk Wadup State says, "Bravo to the government of Upper Nile State for showing concern for your citizens who are suffering due to displacement from their homes." Akon goes on, "I wish the national government would quickly intervene and save the lives of innocent displaced civilians who are stranded in Malakal town so they can resume their normal lives." A person who identifies himself as Hoth in the UNMIS camp says, "Government forces deployed next to the UNMIS gate to search for weapons among IDPs entering the camp are now harassing those civilians seeking safety in the UNMIS compound." Hoth says, "They are beating them, taking whatever belongs to the IDPs." He continues, "I am really confused as to why civilians have to be treated like that. I am among those who have been mistreated this way." James Manasseh in Yambio, Western Equatoria State writes, "The major problems in our country are tribalism, segregation, and corruption." He says, "The time we were in the bush fighting the Khartoum government, the three problems were not there." He asks, "Where are we headed now?" Another question, this time for President Salva Kiir, is posed by Justine Bikoyo Gaetano from Namaiku, Nzara County, Western Equatoria State. She asks, "Why have you abandoned education and health?" Gaetano says, "By giving bonuses only to soldiers, this clearly shows that teachers and doctors are nothing to you." And Deng Gwet Ayat from Gogrial, West County in Wadup State asks, "Who will be blamed for the plight of students whose studies have been disrupted by the ongoing conflict and those in Upper Nile region who are still studying but have no hope for the future due to the conflict?" Dario Donato from Nzara County, Western Equatoria State says, "I think it will be too late for East African countries to deploy a force in South Sudan mid-next month." He adds, "I think it is better that they do it now." And finally, Mamer Akon Bol in Wadup State writes, "The regional bloc IGAD should fulfill their obligation to end 3 months of impunity in this country in order for South Sudanese to live in peace and harmony." We welcome your comments. You can reach us by text or on the web at southsudaninfocus@voanews.com. I'm Gwen Uten in Washington.
We read listener comments on Fridays. These comments come from you, our listeners, and they reflect the views of the commentator only. The comments do not represent the views of anyone on this program or the Voice of America. South Africa has made clear it intends to add several more nuclear power plants to its current energy mix. There are 21 African countries thinking about pursuing nuclear power. With more than 600 million Africans off the energy grid, the nuclear power is being promoted as a clean and efficient answer. But as Peter Cox reports from Johannesburg, some activists worry about the cost and the environment and potential security hazards.
Dominique Gilbert lives near the Pelindaba Nuclear Research Center. That is where, from the 1960s to the 1980s, the South African government developed atomic bombs before becoming the first country to ever voluntarily give up nuclear weapons. When she drives by the dam next to the facility, where uranium is still enriched, she sees men casting lines into the water and eating the fish they pull out.
People eating that fish haven't been stopped fishing there?
Gilbert is a founding member of the Coalition Against Nuclear Energy South Africa. She's worried that the South African government, facing a severe energy shortage, is rushing plans for more nuclear power without public awareness of the downside.
Unfortunately, there hasn't been that much information spread around the general public about the dangers of nuclear and certainly the costs of nuclear. So it's not just health, but we believe it will bankrupt this country. It's totally and utterly unaffordable.
South Africa currently has two nuclear reactors at its Coburg nuclear power station. The waste from those reactors is disposed at the Valpuz radioactive waste disposal facility. Gilbert says South Africa has done little to study the effects of nuclear energy on surrounding communities or to educate the public.
First of all, is air releases, because people can't see radiation. They can't smell it. They can't touch it. But these particles are floating around all the time, and particularly during accidents. During routine operations, there are emissions all the time. Another aspect that worries us enormously is the river, because nuclear technologies and reactors and so forth are highly dependent on water. Pelindaba, for example, uses or releases what they term low-level radioactive waste by the thousands of liters into the Crocodile River.
While such concerns about radiation exposure have been around for decades globally, some experts believe that nuclear fuel actually poses fewer health risks than something like coal, on which South Africa is heavily dependent. Kelvin Kem is a nuclear physicist and chief executive of Nuclear Africa.
Of all the energy sources that there are, nuclear has shown itself to be the safest. And it's quite amazing how much of a public misperception there is about this, that there's been absolute scare tactics developed.
But the 2011 earthquake and tsunami in Japan damaged its Fukushima nuclear plant, resulting in the meltdown of three of its six reactors. The country is still battling to contain radiation leaks, and the impact has been felt globally. Activists say there is good reason to be scared. Kem disagrees.
At Fukushima, they call it a nuclear disaster. It was not a nuclear disaster. Not one single person was killed at Fukushima by radiation. Not one single person was injured at Fukushima by radiation. Not one bit of private property was harmed by radiation at Fukushima. Nothing. There was a general disaster from the tsunami and the earthquake, but there was no nuclear problem as such.
In a State of the Nation address, South African President Jacob Zuma said the country will be moving forward with a project to give the country 9,600 megawatts of nuclear energy. Peter Cox for VOA News, Johannesburg.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. Counterproductive is what Russia is calling a United Nations resolution that refuses to recognize its annexation of the Crimean Peninsula from Ukraine. In today's statement, the Russian Foreign Ministry said the UN General Assembly resolution will only complicate efforts to settle Ukraine's internal political crisis. The ministry accused Ukraine of trying to distract viewers from domestic tensions by blaming its problems on Russia. U.S. President Barack Obama plans to meet today in Saudi Arabia with King Abdullah to address differences over security interests across the Middle East. The talks near the Saudi capital Riyadh are likely to focus mostly on tensions spawned by Syria's civil war. And finally, Australian authorities say the search for the missing Malaysian jetliner has shifted more than 1,000 kilometers northeast in the Indian Ocean. And that's a look at today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
Western Bahr al-Ghazal officials used yesterday's World Theater Day to launch a three-day celebration calling for peace. Hundreds of citizens have come to participate in and watch skit about unity and reconciliation. The annual celebration was started more than 50 years ago by the International Theater Institute. Michael Atit attended last night's event in Wau and has this story for VOA.
When I'm looking on the mirror, I will see your beautiful face. Look at me with an eye, it's mine.
19-year-old Roselyne Edward Joseph was one of the hundreds of people who gathered at Wau Cultural Center to watch a performance of the new play, I Am Tired of War, by the Amaos Cultural Group. The play is about a family that is constantly fighting because the husband spends his time drinking instead of helping to take care of the family. Over the course of the play, the husband and a wife work to resolve their differences. Joseph describes what she took away from the performance.
Theater, it can touch the hearts of people because when you see the things which you are doing, it's bad, and then you saw it there in theater, you are going to sit down and recall the things which in your mind you did it badly. You say, no, let me change this one so that because I see the new things there in theater, let me change myself so that I will be in the other side of the people which are doing good.
Fighting that started in mid-December in Juba spread across much of the country, but never came to Western Bahr al-Ghazal. And officials here say they want to keep it that way. State Minister of Culture Derek Uya Alfred says the World Theatre Day presented a great opportunity to encourage people to remain peaceful.
As a government trying to address this nation in a different style, politically, artistically, culturally, socially, and so on. And at the end of the day, the outcome will be peaceful society, people who respect each other, people who appreciate each other in terms of culture, languages, in terms of differences.
Alfred's ministry recruited 7 different local drama groups to write plays about peace and reconciliation. Mangisto Chan is a member of the Emmaus Cultural Group. He says people can learn from theater, which is why he wanted to participate.
We want to change our community through simple arts. For instance, now we are facing the issue of tribalism. We perform plays against tribalism. Then anyone who has the spirit of love and good things definitely will change. Most of the messages that we are now concentrating on focus on the unity of our people.
The performances are scheduled to run through tomorrow. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Wau.
That's our show for this Friday. We now leave you with the song Alamat Sudan by Mo Attack Mo.
Alamas de lega wewa.
We have been listening to Moe Attack Moe with the song Alames Sudan. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening and have a peaceful weekend. We'll see you back here next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.